Thank you so much for your precious time. This is the Critical Care Commute podcast, where we talk to the widest range of experts relevant to acute care medicine. This is Peter Brindley, a critical care physician, somewhat opinionated, hopefully just the right side of provocative, professor at the University of Alberta Hospital.
And I'm Leon Baker, the unlikely introverted podcaster and critical care physician working out in the community in Edmonton, Canada. By the way, you can claim continuous professional development points for these. Go check out your local college's website.
Step-by-step instructions for the Canadians on the website. Thank you so much. Today's guest is, in my estimation and the internet's, the best-known health reporter in Canada for the best-known national newspaper in Canada, the Globe and Mail, where he's apparently been a journalist since 1987. Well done just for persistence, Andre. That's incredible. Andre Picard's a best-selling author of six books, two-time winner at Canada's National Newspaper Awards, received the prestigious Michener Award for public service. I love this one. Named Canada's first public health hero, a champion of mental health, received the late Queen's Diamond Jubilee Medal, and has eight honorary degrees, including one, I hope and believe, from my university, the University of Alberta. Andre Picard, health reporter for the Globe and Mail, thank you so much for taking time out.
Hi, nice to be there.
Well, it's a pleasure to have you here. Why are you on here? Well, you're on here for all of those reasons, but you know what? My friends in business say we're all in sales, and my friends in the media say we're all in the communication business. So it's on that latter indication. Let's start with a very general question. You've been a journalist and a highly heralded one. Should people still be going into that profession asking for a child of mine?
Well, I think, you know, even when I started 40 years ago, they were telling us, oh, there's no jobs, etc. I think you have to follow your passion. That's what I tell younger people. There's always going to be a need for news, a need to know what's going on in the world. We're going to have to find out how to make that profitable somehow. But I think a younger generation is going to figure it out. So there's always going to be that news. There's always going to be a need for communicators. And it's going to be up to a younger generation to reinvent this profession.
Fantastic. And that sort of mirrors when I'm at a party and somebody says, should my son or daughter go into medicine? It's a similar one. If that's the passion, you follow your passion and you will find your way. So let's find our way within medical communication, because there was a time when doctors put on a white coat, stayed as far as they could away from media. Newspapers would phone us and we would hang up. But more and more of us have been dragged in through COVID and have been eager to get in because we want to communicate. You've talked to a lot of doctors over the years. What do we do well? What do we do badly? And do we need media training?
I think what we have to do fundamentally in this brave new world is teach kids how to understand what they're being told. So I think that's the big fundamental problem today is misinformation. So we have to teach young people how to figure out right from wrong, truth from untruth. I think that's the fundamental one going forward. Beyond that, I think communication is not as complicated as we make it. We communicate every single day with each other. We have to get back to the basics, looking people in the eyes, saying what we think, being on the scene. I think we've gotten away from a lot of that in journalism. We sit at our desks in front of computers. We're not out in the world anymore. I'm very lucky that I grew up in this profession in an era when something was going on, the boss would say, off you go, get on a plane, get on a bus, get in a car, go see it. I think there's a thirst for that. We're seeing that, I think, oddly enough, in the world of TikTok. That's what's happening, right? It's really getting back to basics. Here I am. Often it's doing something stupid, but more and more it's here's me on the scene telling you, showing you what's going on. So I think, again, as I said before, I think the news world, the communication world is going to be reinvented, but it's always going to go back to the basics. It's all about telling stories, telling them to your neighbors, what's going on, why does it matter?
No, it's interesting. You know, Canada likes to big up any Canadian hero, and Edmonton even more so. And Marshall McLuhan did his undergrad at the U of A. You know, the medium is the message guy. And there are plenty of mediums out there now. There's, as you say, there's TikTok, there's Instagram, there's, oh God, I don't know, there's probably five since we started this podcast. Are there ones doctors should stay away from? Are there ones doctors should engage? A lot of us are on Twitter or X, which works and doesn't work simultaneously.
And I think doctors are important, but they're not the be-all and end-all. So we often think of doctors, as being the important health communicators, and they're not. The most important health communicators are patients, people who have a lived experience. Physicians have things to share. They have knowledge. But increasingly, you know, as you said at the outset, would you tell your kid to go in medicine? Half or three quarters of what someone learns in medical school now is not going to be useful when they graduate. So I think medical school is, the future of it is about communication. It's how to learn. That's what we have to teach people, how to learn, how to put your new learnings into practice quickly. And that's what modern communication is. So doctors, I think, have an increasingly important role. Again, I think it's going to be about going back to basics. It's about talking one-on-one. Recently, I've become kind of obsessed with AI, with artificial intelligence, and the role it's going to have in healthcare. And I think if we do it right, if we use AI correctly, it's going to be about freeing up health professionals like doctors from all this paperwork and nonsense, and actually being able to sit down and talk to people. What's really wrong with you? You know, it's easy to figure out symptoms, but what's the underlying cause? Is it because you're living in poverty? Is it because you have a shitty marriage, et cetera? I think that's what the future of healthcare is about, is really one-on-one communication. And we do a terrible job of that. We don't teach that at all. In medical school, I visit probably every medical school in the country every year to do a little talk to students, but that shouldn't be their communication education. That should be a fundamental part of what they learn every day.
I think you bring up a brilliant point, and I hope a few younger listeners go back 30 seconds and listen to that clip over and over again, because you're talking about something vital to our profession. Something Dr. Shelley Dev, a friend of ours from Toronto, brings up every time we talk to her. You know, patients come into the emergency room with chest pain, and we tell them that this blood test is fine and this ECG is fine, and so on your way. And we don't address their underlying problems. We don't look them in the eye enough. We don't hold their hands. And there is a danger of an increasing high-tech, low-touch medicine. When we do teach students or residents about communication, if we get it right, we often divide it into verbal, what you say, paraverbal, you know, how you look, the volume of your voice, your intonation, your emphasis, and nonverbal, your eye contact, even what you're wearing, how you're sitting. You've been in print journalism, so largely forced to do all of those types of communication via the word. That's quite an art, Andre, if I may say so. How do you get across more than just the facts on a page?
Well, you work at it, you know, you describe, et cetera. You try and bring in the other senses. But, you know, print journalism isn't just print anymore. There's been a blurring of the media. We're told by our bosses now that we're not a newspaper anymore. We're a media company, because we have podcasts, we have audio, we do things like this. Communication now is the full range all the time. And I think, again, to bring it back to physicians, we have to teach that. Some patients in the future, we're going to have to communicate with them by email, by text. The profession is really like, oh my goodness, we can't do that, privacy, et cetera. But we have to do it. We have to communicate with patients the way they communicate with each other. And medicine is always terribly behind on the realities of how patients live.
Yeah, well done. I'm deliberate silence there to allow that point to land. Help me understand, because I told people I was talking to you, and they sort of offered questions. Oh, don't forget to ask him this, and don't forget to ask him that. COVID was quite a baptism of fire for a number of us. We were pulled in front of cameras, and mics were stuck in our face, and we saw more of media than perhaps we wanted to or needed to. But we also saw a sort of arc where, you know, we were popular, then we were vilified. Can you help me understand that? Because you must know something about, you release a story, it's very popular, then there's a backlash, then the person who wrote the story becomes the backlash. You know, Anthony Fauci is known to most doctors as one of the beloved editors of Harrison's, which is an incredible, I don't know, 700-800 page long textbook. And he went from that to apparently being involved in all sorts of nasty tricks alongside his acolyte, Bill Gates. You know, how do you negotiate that sort of hype cycle of popular, unpopular, vilified, and how do we?
I think that cycle is existed forever. It's entirely predictable. But in the modern world, it's just amplified. You know, we have the internet, we have all these social media. So what happened during the pandemic? I often say this to people. People always say, because I got a lot of attention during the pandemic for doing what I've been doing for 40 years, which I found funny. But I said, these people said, how did you know all this stuff was going to happen? And I said, because it was entirely predictable. When the pandemic came along, the first thing I did is went back and, you know, when I started to dawn on me that, yeah, this is going to be a big deal, I went back and read what I think is the ultimate book about the 1918-19 flu pandemic called the Great Influenza. I went back and reread that book, a fabulous book. Everything that I read in there is exactly how COVID-19 unfolded. Mm-hmm. It's entirely predictable. Solidarity at the beginning, everybody rallies around. People get tired of the measures. They get angry. Misinformation spreads. Everything that happened 120 years ago happened again, but it just happened in hyper speed and in a much greater depth and breadth. So I think these things, we have to know they're going to happen, and we have to just, you know, be there, suck it up to a certain degree is the approach I took as a journalist.
Well, and I think the subtext there is that people are people, and they're just going to experience each pandemic as a person, and that's going to be molded by the media around them and the ways of communicating around them. Which brings us to, we've talked to Tim Caulfield from the U of A on all about information, disinformation, and the battle for both. I mean, you know, we now have statements like true facts or my facts, which when I was a schoolboy in England, that would have been called tautology, and you would have been slapped around the head for using the irrelevant word true, because if it's a fact, it's a fact. Your experience of these sort of train tracks of truth that we have now, where different people are on different tracks and their social media feed is amplifying their beliefs and we're moving ever further apart. Sorry, I'm sounding a bit polemical with all of this, but do you recognize what I'm saying?
Yeah, absolutely. You know, no one says it better than Tim Caulfield. He's a master at talking about this. But I agree with what he says, is that, again, this has always existed. But the difference today is we amplify this and we give it a home, if you will. And the home is called the internet. It's called Twitter. The only difference today than, you know, I often say, when Jenner invented the first vaccine in 1786, I'm pretty sure there were anti-vaccine protesters outside his house the next day, right? But they didn't have a Twitter account. And, you know, we kind of ignored them because we're a few of them. I remind people that I lived in Montreal for a long time. In 1905 in Montreal, there was one of the biggest smallpox outbreaks in the world. There was a smallpox vaccine available. 20,000 people took to the street in an anti-vaccine protest. That was one quarter of the entire city's population. We don't have anything of that breadth and depth anymore. Anti-vaccine sentiment is no greater today than it's ever been. We just pay much too much attention to it. So I think we have to stick to the science, promote the science, recognize there's always going to be a few outliers. And I think the thing we can't do is allow these untruths, these so-called alternative facts to be weaponized by people with real power, the Trumps of the world, the Elon Musks of the world. Those are the real dangers. It's not a few lost souls who think that vaccines make them magnetic. That doesn't matter. What matters is that people with power are exploiting this to undermine democracy, to give themselves power, to build kleptocracies. That's the reality. That's the disturbing part.
What constitutes an expert? You know, lots of people have opinions. You've talked to these people. You probably have a pretty good radar for whether somebody is just full of it or whether they're a good performer, whether they truly have substance. And often those people don't want to enter the ring of public opinion. What's your sense? You know, do doctors overspeak? Do we suggest we have a confidence we don't? Do we say I don't know when we ought to? Lots of questions within that. I just want to give you freedom to dissect the doctor personality, because you must have interacted with lots of us.
Well, I do. I have to say, when I speak to medical students, I often say that the three most important words they have to learn are I don't know. Yeah. There's no shame in saying that. So I'll start with that one. I think, you know, what is an expert is a very difficult question to answer. It's very contextual. But I think when it comes to science, it's someone who's studied something, who has a rational explanations, etc. There's patient expertise, which is something different altogether, lived experience. These are all different things that fit together in a puzzle in different ways. But I think it's easier to tell us what expertise is not. Expertise is not, I believe this and I'm going to go look for the craziest things possible to back it up. That's not expertise. So there has to be a rationality in there. There has to be, you know, a lot of these arguments that are made by anti-vaxxers, anti-science people, they just don't have plausibility. So I think, though, that's the main thing. There has to be some plausibility in your argument. This is biologically possible. You know, these very simple things we don't pay enough attention to. Do doctors get too much attention? Maybe, but doctors have training. They should be able to understand science more broadly. I think the disturbing thing to me is when doctors go stray a lot out of their lane. And we saw a lot of this in COVID. Suddenly, everyone was a COVID expert, right? From the veterinarian to the GP to the epidemiologist to you name it. The cancer, you know, there's the Vinny Prasads of the world who... A very good cancer researcher who's now, you know, just talks about COVID constantly and has just become a crank, unfortunately. He's still a very good cancer researcher. So I think that that's part of the problem is people have strayed a bit far from their actual expertise.
Well, I mean, my own personal experience was a certain media outlet would phone me and say, will you go on the news at 12 o'clock and say the following? And I would say, no, but I'm happy to arrange a time sometime today. You can phone me, ask me any questions you want, and I'll give you my unvarnished opinion. And no, we don't want that. So there was sort of complicity on both sides. You know, you've said we need to teach communication. I think we also need to teach the scientific method more broadly. Our job is to attack our biases. There's a whole theory about proving and disproving the null hypothesis. In other words, we should be out there trying to knock down our ideas. And if our ideas hold up, then they edge ever closer to the truth. I don't feel this is being taught in school, but how do we get those genuine ideas out there? Because science is still seen as sort of boring and pessimistic and overly cautious, but it's life-saving.
Yeah, I think we have to do that to a certain extent in our studies, but I don't think we should expect every person to be a scientist every day. I think our daily life has to operate on a foundation of trust. And to me, that's the worst thing that happened in COVID is we've lost this trust. Trust is evaporated because there's so much disinformation, because there's so much irrational self-interest out there. I think that's what's disturbing. We should be able to go through our lives and think, the experts tell me this is a vaccine, it works, I'm going to get it. That should be the end of the story. We should have some, I wonder if I should get it tomorrow or next week, or do I need two or one? I think there should be some basic thinking and wondering going on there, but I don't think we should be questioning every single thing. And if there's a system of trust, then we shouldn't have to do that.
Yeah, great point. I mean, it also leads to analysis paralysis, where if you're not certain about something, you do nothing. And that's sort of where I go back to the luxury of you can now have a thought in your head about whether you want a vaccine rather than seeing that as, my God, I better be at the front of the line so it saves my life. So 5 years from now, 10 years from now, have we sorted this out? Have we become more used to the internet and therefore adjusted to it? Or does it just keep going and going and going?
Yeah, maybe I may be unusual as a journalist, but I'm pretty hopeful. I think the younger generation is way smarter about this stuff. They're much more savvy. If you just look how younger people use the internet, it's very different than my generation. The problem, to be honest, in social media is my generation. Who posts nonsense on Facebook? It's people over 50. It's not young people. They're very, very cautious. They all have private accounts. They're much more thoughtful in their analysis about what they read, etc. They're very picky, which is maybe not good for the kind of media I work in, you know, very generalized. But that landscape, the world is changing. And I do think that younger people are going to adjust to this quite well. I just worry that what the damage that's going to be done in the meantime by the Trumps of the world, because they're really using misinformation to undermine democracy. That to me is the biggest concern, much more than any of this science or health stuff. It's that fundamental destruction of democracy.
And And do you think that's conscious, Andre? I mean, are these people working out how to manipulate media, or is it just on a sort of unconscious level that this is just happening?
It's absolutely conscious, and it's evil, I have no doubt.
Andre, if I might, you mentioned several times, you know, that the landscape has been changing, social media is playing an increasing role. Young people, not the problem, older people, perhaps. How about institutions? Do you think institutions like medical schools are doing enough? Are they involved enough, you know, to combat, if you will, misinformation? Or should every single medical school or major department, science department, have a director of social media and content generators?
Yeah, I don't think medical health sciences schools are doing near enough. I think education needs to be pretty fundamentally rethought. I think that's beginning to happen. But it's something I alluded to earlier. I think we have to teach medical practitioners how to learn better rather than teach mm-hmm. them stuff. We still are in this mode where we just cram their heads full of crap that's not going to be very useful in their careers. Mm-hmm. And we have to teach them how to learn and how to communicate. So no, I don't think institutions are doing enough. I don't know if the solution is to have a vice president of social media. I don't know if the solution is to have more bureaucracy. I somehow doubt it. But I think the solution is to have different kind of students. I think a lot of medical students we choose are the wrong people. They don't know how to communicate. You know, they're brilliant in the classroom. They get 99.9% on their math tests. And if they can't talk to a grandmother, they're not a useful doctor, in my opinion. That's why we don't have enough family doctors, because we're drawing the wrong kind of people. We have to, I think, decentralize the way we teach. We know that if we want people to practice in rural areas, that's where they have to learn. So we, you know, schools have to me, it comes back to, now you've got me on a whole other topic.
No, keep going. We're nodding our heads vigorously. Keep going.
But, you know, the future of medicine is right now medicine's all about bringing people to institutions, and the future of medicine is about bringing healthcare to people. That's going to be the fundamental shift in the next century, and I think that has to begin with learners. People have to start learning out in the community where they're going to practice. Right now, it's all so institutional that it's broken. We have to fundamentally rethink this mathematics of how we teach and where we learn.
And when it comes to knowledge translation, how do you see the influence of social media? Is it good? Is it bad? Are we doing enough again as institutions?
Social media is a tool, and we have to know how to learn that tool the same way they learn how to use a stethoscope wisely. They have to learn how to use Twitter wisely. To me, these are just tools in this ever-expanding toolbox, artificial intelligence, same thing. Really powerful tool if used properly. And I think the real power of artificial intelligence for medicine is it should free up people to actually be people. You know, let the bot do all this transcribing, et cetera, analysis, and you actually talk to the person to figure out the right questions to ask, to pump into the bot to get answers. So to me, again, it's a rethinking of how we communicate and how we treat.
Yeah, fair enough. So again, another soundbite here is it's the old farts. They're the problem. The young ones understand. They've swum in this water their whole life. Tell us about your books. You've been ludicrously successful writing books about public health. Now, that's a skill in and of itself to engage the public in that topic. You know, people like whiz bangs. They like machines that go beep. But you've really brought to life the idea of public health. I know why it matters so much. And in fact, every ICU doctor eventually thinks, just a second, I should have gone into public health. I could have made changes at the population level. But why don't you tell us why public health matters so much to you, and mental health?
I think it's just because it's the closest thing to our daily lives. You know, this, I think the most important thing I realized early in my career was this notion of someone teaching me about the social determinants of health, about what matters to us is not medicine. It's about having an income, a roof over our heads, food on the table, not being lonely, having an education. This is what health is about. And that's what I've spent 40 years writing about rather than medicine. So I think that I was lucky to have that teaching early in my life. You know, my books are niche, we have to be honest. You know, a successful
book. Well, they're bestsellers.
Yes, well, I have, you know, a bestseller in Canada is maybe a break even. That's my new goal with books. So we have to put this into some perspective. But yeah, it's nice to have that attention. The books to me are just an extension of my daily work. You know, in daily work, you kind of do a snapshot. The book is more of a documentary or motion picture, if I'm being overly enthusiastic. But, you know, the books are just a way of bringing bigger topics together. Like during COVID, I wrote about elder care, which is, you know, there was this massacre of neglect of our seniors during the pandemic. So I just took it as an opportunity to write about a bigger topic. But unfortunately, I think these are very much niche issues. And I don't think that's necessarily a bad thing. People shouldn't have to think about this. We should have good lives. We should have a good social safety net. And that should be the norm. And we shouldn't have to think about this, to be honest.
And your book on elder care is fantastic, and I would highly recommend it. And it really does bring up some of those ideas about the need for community and loneliness that people feel and a sense of atomization. Please, just discuss that more, because I worry that we spend so much time talking about whiz-bangery at the bleeding edge of healthcare that these social determinants, especially loneliness, especially community, for which there isn't a drug, but my goodness me, there are things we could do. Are we letting down the public? Is that too bombastic to put it that way?
No, I think we are letting down the public. I think we're not giving them tools to be healthy. You know, we love these miracle cures, the blueberry a day or whatever, or genomics, artificial intelligence is the new great savior. But the reality has always been the same for thousands of years. That's what makes us healthy, having three square meals a day and somewhere safe to live and having a family, having connections. That's really fundamentally what matters to humans. It always has and it always will. And we have to figure out how to make that important in people's lives. We don't have to have sophisticated, complex solutions to everything. There are a lot of, often the most simple thing is the most important. I like to use the line that the most powerful drug we have is money, and we just don't prescribe it very well. You know, the problem in our society is that the wealth is distributed very unevenly. Some people have way too much and some people have way too little. And a lot of us are just in the middle there, kind of struggling to hang on.
All right. And I want to pick up on something you mentioned, and I hope, I imagine this can take, this will be a podcast in itself, but primary care, rethinking primary care, taking it out of institutions' hands, if you will, and bringing it to the community. What are your thoughts on fixing primary care in Canada?
Well, primary care is the foundation of medicine. If we build on a shaky foundation, the whole rest of the system collapses. And that's what we're seeing in real time in Canada today. We have terrible primary care. Every person in Canada should have a primary care practitioner, preferably a family doctor. And we should be building from that. In Canada, we have 6.5 million people without a family doctor. It's unconscionable. And it's why we have all these other problems. It's the ripple effect. Why are the emergency rooms full? Why are long-term care homes overflowing? Do we have waits for surgery? It all comes back to we're not doing the basics well. So I know I've been coming back to this theme throughout, but it's all about the basics. Once you get the fundamentals right in any profession, any area of society, you have to start with the basics, whether it's, you know, a hockey player learning to skate. In medicine, the equivalent is a system doing primary care well. And if you don't do that, the rest is just not going to work.
What a fabulous point. And I don't want to dilute that point by piling on other questions. It's been an absolute delight, Andre. I could chat with you for several hours. Leon, let's let this man get back to his day in glorious Vancouver.
I could rant about this stuff all day.
Well, don't threaten. We'll have you back on every week.
Yeah, you bet. Thank you so much for joining us.
The health information offered on the Critical Care Commute podcast and the resources available for download through the podcast and show notes is provided for general informational and educational purposes only. It is not intended as a substitute for professional medical advice, diagnosis, or treatment.